Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, which is now part of Intelligent Investor, finance presenter on ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And we are
The Money Cafe.
You had an interesting piece this morning about banks.
Yes.
And, you know, how they're...
The Magnificent
they're,
Four.
They're at their peak levels, right?
35 years, bank stocks have never been so richly valued.
So I want to put to you that it's partly as a result of long COVID.
Sure.
Because today, or this week, is the fourth anniversary of the pandemic, right?
Yes.
And it's the fourth anniversary of the WHO declaring it a pandemic.
Mm.
The federal government's first stimulus package.
Yes.
Where they gave $750 to everybody who was on some sort of pension. And also the supermarkets ran out of toilet paper. This time.
Good times.
Four years ago. Great times. Anyway, so I looked into what's happened as a result of long COVID. So obviously there's a medical long COVID. People are getting really terrible symptoms that are incurable, brain fog and so on. But I was looking at the economic long COVID, and the key thing, I think, is that house prices have gone up 38%.
Yes.
Since March 2020.
Yep.
Right?
Okay.
And that's added $3 trillion to the value of Australian housing.
Right.
And increased household debt from $2 trillion to $3
trillion. Oof.
So the banks basically have increased their loan books by $1 trillion. And at the same time, interest rates have gone from 2%, this is the mortgage rate, has gone from 2% to 6.8%.
Yes.
So repayments, right, have gone from $9 billion a month to $21 billion a month.
Yep, okay, gotcha.
So
the banks are getting fat on that as
well. Well, I'm just suggesting this may have something to do with the high share prices.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a sort of story of 2 years ago, though, largely, right? Credit growth has slowed in the last couple of years. So why are banks' share prices on a tear in the last 18 weeks, I guess?
Well, it just seems to me that the increase in house prices underpins their lending for a while. I mean, it's not as if...
This
is a kind of a once-off, a permanent increase in house prices. They're not going to come down again.
No.
Or if not, you know, not by much. Anyway.
No, but lending growth is pretty tepid.
Right.
At the moment. So I think what it's more about is there's lots of theories, including international investors parking money in the banks because they're safe and liquid. And but I think it's more about investors looking ahead and saying rates will eventually come down. That will improve housing affordability and that will spur credit growth over time.
And spur house prices again, do you think?
Oh, well, you'd think so, yeah. Yep.
That's great.
The question there, though, and this is what the piece talks about, is that'll probably take 2 or 3 years to come through, that increase in improvement in lending growth. But shares have been bid up to levels we haven't seen now. So are bank investors sort of cruising to hit an air pocket where they've priced in all this, the good times ahead, but the good times don't come for 2 or 3 years? And in the meantime, the banks are facing pretty stiff competition in deposits and mortgages. Credit growth isn't great. Bad debts are probably ticking up and their costs are going up.
So this is what your man from UBS is saying, the bank analyst. What's his name? Story?
John Story.
John Story. He's saying, you know, look out for an air pocket. I suppose if there was an air pocket and they came down by, what, 10, 20%, that'd be a buying opportunity.
Well, right? and this is the thing, you know, he's like every bank analyst. They've all got sells on most of the banks. Investors don't care. You will prize their bank shares out of their cold, dead hands. That they just love these things.
Hmm.
I mean, the dividend yield on CBA shares is now as low as it's been, if you exclude the pandemic where they cut dividends, it's as low as it's been in 20 years.
What is it?
It's 3.9%.
Right.
So that's fine, but it's nothing to write home
about. 3.4% sort of fully franked is okay.
It's okay, but you can get 5% off your cash in the bank. Like, really? That's okay?
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, it's actually pretty crappy.
Speaking of banks, what did you learn from Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan Chase?
Well, I think he's sort of agreeing with your long COVID theory in a way. The amount of fiscal stimulus from the pandemic still in the system is still, in his view, still propping up economies, still washing its way through. We're sort of hooked on it, like a bit like heroin, he says.
Did he say heroin?
Oh, well, he said drugs coursing through the system. And his view is that we just haven't seen these long lag effects from interest rates yet. So, you know, everyone and their dog are predicting a soft landing, no recession, everything's great. He's still got a 65% chance of a recession, and he doesn't rule out stagflation or a hard recession. So, you know, I think it's just a good note of caution. He says the Fed shouldn't be cutting rates. Inflation is still on the horizon, and, you know, don't move before June. So, look, he beamed in from New York. He was in a sort of...
What was it, a press conference or just...
No, we had our business summit at the AFR this week.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
And so we were on stage and he was in great form. So he can talk about everything. He talked about everything from barbecuing steaks and drinking martinis to AI and, you know, Bitcoin.
He's been running JP Morgan for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's coming... I think the 18th year.
18 years.
Yeah. But, like, you know, he's reached that great stage, which you would have seen with leaders, where they're so entrenched, so sort of powerful that they can just say anything. You know, they're not worried about the repercussions.
So what do you say about Bitcoin?
He will defend your right to smoke a cigarette. He will defend your right to buy a Bitcoin, but he will never buy one himself. Doesn't see the use cases for it. Believes most of its uses are nefarious for criminal activity. Is a believer in blockchain, but not Bitcoin. He doesn't understand why governments don't ban it.
Right. Ban it?
Ban it. Because he thinks it's mainly used for money laundering and other bad stuff. Please don't write in and say, you know, we hate Bitcoin here at the Money Cafe. I'm relaying Jamie Dimon's view.
Yes, no. We don't hate Bitcoin.
Yeah, but it was really interesting. He was in great form and, you know, the interview went all around the world, which is really what happens when you talk to Jamie Dimon and he says the Fed shouldn't cut rates.
Right. Ever.
No, he's just saying that, you know, they shouldn't be going in March, they shouldn't be going in May, at least wait till June and just see how this all plays out. Because the CPI number out of the US this week.
Yeah, I was going to say that kind of reinforced his view, really.
Several important categories are now up sort of 1%. And if you annualise it, it looks even worse.
Well, the overall headline inflation rate went up from 3.1 to 3.2.
Yeah.
Which is not much of an increase, but it's still an increase, which is not what they're looking for.
It's a fascinating little point in time because everyone is so bought into this idea that rate cuts are coming, soft landing's here. And, you know, we've seen some stunning stock price moves. November 1 is, as I said, it's 18 weeks ago. And you go onto the ASX and you can see some stock prices that are up, you know, well over 100%, plenty up 50%. It's an extraordinary amount of enthusiasm for a pretty risky world.
Yeah. I had coffee yesterday with a member of the Shadow Cabinet.
Yes.
And among other things, I said, so what's going on with this nuclear line that you're pushing now?
Well, we had Dutton at our summit.
Oh, yeah, what did he say?
Entire speech was about nuclear energy.
Yeah. So I said, why are you doing this? What's the benefit? What's the political...
Please, yeah. What was the answer?
He said, well, Tony Abbott taught us that when you're in opposition, you don't get much of an opportunity to get your message out. You've got one or two messages and you've got to make them simple. We reckon nuclear is a simple message. It gives us something to talk about. And, that's kind of where he's... the problem is that you're not really saying what are you going to do about it. You're just saying nuclear energy is a good idea.
Yeah.
But what do you... I mean, it's not going to work on its own. How are you going to do it?
Yeah.
What are you going to build these nuclear... You know, the government... Is the government going to build them, the coalition government? And the answer is what he wants is a capacity mechanism. What they want is a capacity mechanism or a capacity market, where what happens is the AEMO, the energy market operator, auctions capacity. Do you know what I mean by that? Have you heard of this?
No.
So a lot of countries have.
I'm just getting back to that idea that the coalition is selling a simple message as you explain a capacity mechanism, please.
Well, they haven't mentioned capacity
mechanism.
They have done a capacity mechanism in the past.
Yeah.
Some countries basically split their power bills into the actual transmission of the energy and the provision of capacity.
Yes.
The provision of capacity basically backstops the system. The way that it works is that the energy market operator does two auctions basically. They allow people to bid in the power, which is what happens at the moment.
Yes.
Every 5 minutes, everyone bids in their power, and the cheapest price goes out.
Yeah.
But they also have auctions where people are bidding their capacity in 5 years' time.
Hmm.
You know, we bid to provide a megawatt in 5 years.
Yep.
And then that goes on the power bills.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
So it's not a government subsidy, it's basically a consumer subsidy. It goes on, it's part of the power bill is that you're paying for the stability of the system into the future.
Right.
By paying for people to have capacity. And AEMO, this is the theory, would conduct auctions to that, right?
Okay, yep.
And so at the moment, Chris Bowen has announced that the only things that are can be bid into capacity for capacity are renewables and hydrogen.
Okay, yes.
Not fossil fuels and not nuclear, right, because nuclear is banned. And so what the coalition basically wants to do is make the capacity mechanism, capacity market, technology neutral.
Yep.
Right?
Okay, yep.
And they say that if it was technology neutral, nuclear would have a place. They would win some auctions. Somebody would win an auction to provide nuclear capacity in 5 or 10 years.
Okay.
That's the idea.
My God, that is so complex, Alan. And this is the bit I sort of don't get. Do you think this is nuclear advocacy is a cut through issue for the coalition? I mean, the way Dutton sort of sold it, there was none of that capacity mechanism talk. It was just this will make your power bills cheaper. Renewables are going to be really expensive. They're not working.
Well, that's actually, I suppose you'd call it a lie. I mean, it will not make power bills cheaper. That is absolutely untrue.
Right.
I think where it's cut through is in the bush, where the farmers are freaking out about power lines and wind farms and solar farms taking up their land, right?
Mm.
And the whole idea...
Rightly or wrongly.
This shadow cabinet minister said that the whole idea with nuclear is that they build the reactors where the coal-fired power stations are, and there's no new transmission lines.
Yeah.
Which is not only a saving, but and a big saving, but it's also, it also means that you don't have to sully people's land.
Yeah, but the reactors, and this is the other part of it, I think, that Dutton spoke to, the reactors are probably minimum 20, 15 years away.
Well,
30, so thermal coal will need to keep running for longer. I mean, Ted O'Brien was quite clear about that.
Yeah. So a lot of people are saying, oh, it's only so they can keep coal going longer, which probably is right. I mean, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago saying that the nuclear ban is ridiculous and should be dropped because, obviously, I think it is. I can't see why you'd ban it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's have the debate. Let's have the debate.
Let's see if somebody wants to build one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not the government. If somebody wants to build one, fine, go ahead.
I still come back to this idea. Do you think people in the suburbs are really going to – this is going to be what swings them to the coalition?
No,
so
absolutely
not. You know, to your original point, or Tony Abbott's point, you get one or two messages.
Is this the one they want to get out?
Yeah, sure. It's a tough debate.
Just before we move to questions, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Is it time to brush up on your investing skills and knowledge? Well, InvestSmart's Investor Bootcamp is for you. Learn the fundamentals of investing, how to form better money habits, and what it takes to build long-term wealth. Do it at your own pace over 3 months, with the option to participate in live weekly webinars to consolidate your learning. Usually $99, Money Cafe listeners can get $40 off with the code MONEY40. Visit investsmart.com.au/bootcamp and use MONEY40 to save $40.
Jason says, I'm 30 years old and unsure what the best financial strategy is. Do I salary sacrifice some super to reduce my tax, approximately 37%, or do I pay down my home loan as fast as I can? Love your podcast and would love to see a live show one day.
You can come anytime to Leclerc Cafe and see it live.
We're in Leclerc Cafe, Glenfree Road, Hawthorne.
I'll even let you buy me a hot chocolate.
But we don't know where Jason lives and we're not paying your airfare, Jason. Sorry.
Well, particularly as he's trying to save responsibly.
He is. What do you reckon?
Oh, look, we
can't give personal advice.
But I think generally, can he do a bit of both? Can he put as much as possible into super, extra into super to get his contributions high there, and then focus on paying down his home loan while interest rates are high? That would feel to me to be a pretty generally smart play.
Yeah. I'd say in general, this is not personal advice, Jason. Your circumstances are something I don't understand, but I would go pay down your home loan because you don't want to retire with debt, really. I mean, but yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Anyway, next.
I'm going to go to Bernie's question. Bernie says, I've just read the transcript of the Money Cafe for this week. As always, insightful and entertaining, but I'd like to take issue with Stephen's view that the CEO salaries should be reported post-tax, not pre-tax, just like corporate profits. Wouldn't that require publication of each CEO's tax returns? Certainly a novel idea, but there could be some privacy implication. What do you think?
Nah, I can't see the point, really. I mean, well, you wouldn't have to look, if you publish both their gross wage and their net wage, you would then get some private information because you'd understand what tax they were paying. Obviously, I presume I didn't hear Stephen. I presume he's. This is what he says.
He does have an answer. Yes, he says. Stephen says, in his defence, you could do a broad estimate of 40% across the board for all CEOs and use that as a sort of standard thing.
Can't see the point.
Yeah,
of that.
I can't see the point. I think it's probably best to do pre-tax, and then you know people can assume that their CEO is. Managing their tax affairs appropriately.
Alex says, could you please discuss the suggestion of negative gearing to be available to new builds exclusively with a 5-year moratorium to transition? Would this redirect all building investment funds to be used to create a much larger rental capacity without being inflationary at the same time create more jobs? Well, that's what the ALP proposed in 2016 and 2019, which was focusing or confining negative gearing to new builds.
Yeah.
And they didn't get it up. No. Or they didn't win. So it didn't happen. But I presume it would tend to encourage new builds.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Yes, yes.
I think it makes sense to say that we don't want to let you deduct, you know, your losses on existing builds because we've got enough. That's just driving up the prices of existing houses. I think that makes some sense.
And it would also seem to support, I mean, the government's got a very ambitious construction target. They need to do 120,000 over 5 years new homes. It would seem to support that, so might be worth considering.
Let's go to Gavin.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. I'm a member of Rest Super, and as I am young, I've opted for the high growth option. I understand that with choice comes higher risk, and perhaps the following can be attributed to that. However, the same can be said for their core strategy. RestSuper have released their recent investment performance updates with their high growth and core strategies achieving 12.52% and 10.05% respectively, and they've given themselves a nice pat on the back. What they fail to mention is that for the same time, their balanced index strategy with no fees associated achieved 13.87%. In fact, comparing the balanced index strategy with their own balanced strategy over the last 5 years, the index strategy beats the managed one by over 2% per annum. Am I just actually paying this super fund to lose me money? Should us members be more mad about this, and why is no one talking about it?
Yeah, so I was quite skeptical about the balanced index strategy having zero fees. So I looked up their website and it's true.
So that's because you pay an additional fee when you go into one of these managed strategies. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously there's an administration fee. So Rest makes, I can't remember what it is. It's an amount, I can't remember what it is now. A dollar something per week administration and then $78 a year or something.
Yeah.
So there is a fee. There is a fee, but there's no investment fees.
Right.
Whereas all of the other strategies, core and balanced, do have fees. And it's really interesting. I mean, because they are charging for a lower performance, according to this. But that's on a one-year basis. But it is true that over 5 years, the index strategy beats the managed one by 2%. Mm. That's true. Mm. So, yeah, you are paying them to lose your, well, to do less well.
Yes.
They're not losing you money, Gavin. They're just not doing quite as well.
And I guess to Gavin's original point, over time that might change. Like over 25 years or 15 years, the high growth strategy does outperform. But there is that risk that...
Well, they haven't over 5 years. So I think it's fair, like, yeah. I mean, I'd go into the index strategy. Why not? I mean, they're obviously not... I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean... Yeah, it's fascinating. Because I presume the high growth and the balance would have a lot of unlisted assets. I mean, I don't know how the index strategy picks that up.
Well, I didn't get into... I mean, it's possible they reveal on the website what they're investing in each of these things.
No, they would.
Yeah. And I presume the balance strategy has some private equity and so on in it. But look, private equity hasn't been doing very well.
No.
So, I think it's possible all the unlisted assets, particularly recently as long-term interest rates have gone up, I think a lot of the unlisted assets have done poorly.
Yeah. The one thing I did think about this is I presume the high growth basket would have lots of nice tech stocks in it. Or a lot, you know, equities being the sort of riskier asset class would have plenty of equities in it. So... does this change over this year when equity markets are cutting loose? I'm not sure because the indexed and the balanced options would have plenty of equities too, but maybe that's one to watch.
David says, J-Power has made an offer to take over GenX at 0.275, which is not much more than the rejected Grok bid of 18 months ago, which was 0.25. A whole lot of uncertainty has dissipated since then. The battery is making money and the pumped hydro is within 1 year of commissioning as well. As the ASX is going gangbusters. Any thoughts as you interviewed the former CEO at least twice? I did. And I like GenX. I think it's an interesting business.
Yeah.
Do you know much about them?
A little bit, yeah. This is they've got a former mine that you're using for pumped hydro and they're running a giant battery.
Well, also they've got solar farm. I think they've got two solar farms.
Yes, the pumped hydro storage.
Yeah, and they're supplying the power into Gladstone.
Yep.
I
think David makes really good points. This is an issue on the ASX. This is supposed to be the time of the energy transition and investors have been saying for 10 years that we're going to make lots of money out of the energy transition. Energy transition stocks around the world are not going well. And GenX is a little example of that. I don't know what it is, but investors just aren't getting this or valuing this in the way that you might think.
Yeah.
Cheeky question here from Tim, more of a comment. Thanks for the great podcast. Since the Money Cafe's divorce with James Kirby, I've noticed that some astute listeners have arbitraged the situation by double dipping and deploying the same question to both podcasts. This brazen activity occurs without even a name change or alias. There's only one way to know this, of course, as I unfaithfully listen to your podcast as well as James's.
Yeah, well, I think James has been unfairly getting actual experts on his podcast.
Well, it's not. You don't need to. You're not being unfaithful, Tim. There's lots of podcasts out there. Lots of great podcasts.
Jay says, "I and my partner have been looking at buying a property. However, when modelling out the ROI on a property investment, it becomes pretty clear that the PPOR, which stands for Principal Place of Residence Capital Gains Tax Exemption, creates a huge incentive for basically every Australian to buy a property as soon as possible, as it's basically the biggest tax break the everyman can get. What do you think about changing this scheme so it caps out at, say, a certain capital gains threshold, e.g. 250,000 capital gain, following which marginal tax rates apply or the long-term CGT discount applies, obviously depending on the holding period. Being the good Samaritan I am, I think this would go a long way in easing pressure on property prices, could actually rein in housing affordability by reducing the return on property investments." Well, yeah, Jay, the idea with the PPOR exemption is that it's not that the place you live in is not an investment. It's the place you live. But look, I think there's some point about that. It is clearly a big tax break. Yeah. And a lot of people take advantage of it by moving all the time,
yes,
and upgrading and getting tax-free capital gains, which they then plough into the next place.
Yes, which compounds the issue of rising house prices.
It does. That's right.
Jay, as we've said many times in this podcast, I think these ideas are interesting, but which party is going to go to the electorate and say, we're cutting the CGT concession for the very home you live in, dear voter?
No one's going to do it.
This is a question from Mal, which is interesting. I'm wondering how long it will be until the super industry in Australia will start to artificially inflate the ASX. The super funds advertise their balanced funds as representing about 25 to 30% of their investments, so they must invest that percentage. Some simple maths. Wiki tells me the total market cap of the ASX is 1.6 trillion and the super funds are about 3 trillion, so 30% of the 3 trillion invested in the ASX is about 1 trillion. And as money continues to flood into the super funds, also via compounding reinvestment and with no choice except to follow their advertised product strategy, surely there must come a point when they will own the whole market. And then what? It's an interesting idea, isn't it, Alan?
I have actually thought about this myself sometimes. I mean,
yeah.
If you look at the amount of super, which is getting above, well above 3 trillion already.
I think it's 3.5 at the
3.5,
moment.
3.5, yeah. And, you know, theoretically they're putting 40% of it into shares.
Yes.
Well, they are starting to run out.
Shares, particularly as we've said on the podcast in the last few weeks, there's no new companies or very few new companies coming to market.
Which means they have to invest globally.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they're doing. That percentage that he's using, 25 to 30%, I'm not sure that ties them specifically to Australia, as in they need to put 25 to 30% of their money in Australia. And in fact, Australia is going to have to become, mathematically, a much smaller part of their portfolios.
Yeah.
But there's going to be an awful lot of Aussie pension money, super fund money, washing around global markets. It is a really good point.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Simon says, Alan, I just heard James defending the big supermarkets. Did you really?
Yes.
You did. Okay. Saying he doesn't see where they are price gouging and it's not their fault. Blah, blah, blah. Is he for real? Time for some fresh air, James. I live in rural SA and work in agriculture 100%, and the main reason we hate the big supermarkets is the gigantic price difference between what the farmers are paid and what they retail to the consumer for. Over the past 2 years, fresh produce has been generally sold at 5 times to 10 times the price that farmers receive. For example, he's gone about lamb was as low as $4 a kilogram at the farm gate, and every time I check the Woolies price, it ranged from 25 to 40 kilograms. And they wonder why people are angry. So defend yourself, James.
I would gladly defend myself on this. I get the fee opinion. I get the idea that what is paid at the farm gate or in the stockyard is not what you pay on the shelves. But again, this just has to be grounded in some facts. And I'll do the breakdown again from the Coles perspective. So for every $100 in sales, Coles pays $70 to its suppliers. $70, okay? A further $11 or $12 goes to its employees. And there was a nice big wage jump last July. There's going to be another one this year. Just over $15 is in overheads, rent, transport, energy costs, interest expenses, because, you know, running a network across this country is not cheap. You've got to invest in that to get the produce from rural South Australia, where Simon lives, to Hobart. Cost that, there's actually a cost to that. And then, of course, they've got to pay tax, effective tax rate of 30%. Very different to other supermarkets in the UK. They pay about 20% or 21%.
So, and so what 70 Coles, plus 11 plus 15 is 96.
Coles is left with $2.60. $2.60 in net profit. 80% of that goes to their shareholders, most of which are retail investors or super fund members. So I get the anger. I totally get the anger. I don't like going to the supermarket at the moment. It's, you know, our family comes home with extraordinary bills. But I just don't know that those are the facts. Those are how the breakdown works. $100 of sales, Coles gets $2.60, suppliers get $70.
Okay.
I know it's uncomfortable truth and it's not popular, and I've been watching the supermarket inquiry and there's lots of farmers saying this is really tough, but the answer here is that we need to pay more for groceries, not less. Simon and his and the industry should probably be getting more of the pie, but if we want Coles to stay in business at a profit margin of $2.60, which is pretty crappy, we got to make it work. How's that for
there you go.
Strident defence?
Next question.
Toby, can you talk through some of the reasons why politicians want to maintain high immigration despite the obvious impacts to housing affordability and rents? For example, I've heard commentary that it artificially improves GDP. How does that work?
Well, two reasons. There's not enough staff in healthcare, aged care, construction, you name it. And secondly, because they don't give the universities enough money, so they have to, in order to for the universities to stay afloat, they have to get foreign students. So that's the reason for it. But it's true that the construction industry has insufficient capacity to build them houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, clearly the case.
And how do you deal with insufficient capacities, which is mainly about labour?
Exactly.
You bring more labour in. It's a real issue. But I've got to say, Alan, you look on social media particularly, and every discussion about house prices now is immediately linked to immigration levels. Like, I think this is going to be a pretty hot political issue coming into the election next year.
Yeah, but it's clearly, arguably, one of a number of issues.
Oh, totally, and, totally. You
know, like it's,
but it's become sort of quite visceral, rightly or wrongly.
Luke wants to know how the gender pay gap data has worked out. The answer, Luke, is that they ask individual companies. This is the it's an
WEGA.
WEGA.
What's WEGA, what's that which is called for? The Workplace Equality and Gender Agency.
Yes. So they get companies to average the salary of their women and average the salary of their men, and they express the difference as a percentage of the male wage.
Not quite.
Oh.
This year, they did the median, not the average, which is important because next year they will include CEOs' pay in the averages and they will use an average, and the gaps are going to look much bigger. So this year was good. This was a good year for the gender pay gap. It will look bigger next year.
Huh.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
I mean, there's lots of questions about the gender pay gap. Is it sort of oranges with oranges? You know, is it really measuring anything? All of these questions invariably come from men. Don't I've had 25 of them, and they're all from men. I got to say, guys, get over it. Like the women are facing this. The deck is stacked against women when it comes to pay, and broadly, in a patriarchal society that we still operate in, the deck is stacked against women generally. You know. Yeah. Think of who does the caring for children and most of the domestic work.
Sure.
So This is a losing battle. We've got to just keep chipping away at the structural imbalances in the workforce. No one's saying that men have done something bad. We just got to keep working away to make the deck less stacked against women.
Hmm. One of my sons-in-law works in a place where the gender pay gap is in reverse. The women get paid more than men.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, what sector? Can you say what sector?
Professional services.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Yeah. There were some really interesting stats in that gender pay gap, like GrainCorp, which you were an agricultural business, listed agricultural business, the big wheat harvester in Australia. They actually had a really small gender pay gap. We spoke to the CEO. He said we just had to work at it all the time. Like, it's not, you just got to keep whacking away at it. Be thoughtful about how promotions work, what structural obstacles to promotions are there. It's a fascinating thing.
One more question.
Okay. Andrew says, in the most recent show, Alan asserted that a coal power station is much more compact than renewables. While this is true, the size of the coal mines is comparable. The mines up in Singleton and Muswellbrook are huge. This is a question we had a lot last week too, Alan, about the varying sizes of how much space all the types of power take up. Are we getting sidetracked by this a little bit?
Oh, totally. I just think we've got to get
a lot
over
of land here, right?
Yeah. It's like we're going to have take up about 1% of Australia's land mass with renewable energy. You know, like it's not. We have to get over it. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Renewable energy takes more land. It's true that the coal mines are big. That's right. So it's not. If you're only comparing, a generator, a coal-fired power station, with a solar farm or a wind farm, yeah, sure, that's a huge difference. But if you include the coal mine, yep, the difference is less. But still, it's more land. But that's what we're up for.
Yeah,
that's the price of saving the planet.
Yeah, I mean,
you either think there's a problem with climate change or you don't. Mm. I mean. We're heading for disaster, you know, the way things are going. On current world policies, the temperature is going to go well above 2 degrees above pre-industrial, right? It's not going to be 1.5, as everyone sort of promised at Paris.
This is the fascinating thing to me. I reckon the last 6 months, I don't know what you think, but the debate, we seem to be regressing a bit in this debate, as though, okay, we accept the science, but the impetus for the energy transition just seems to be dissipating.
Yeah,
is it the cost of living pressures?
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
It must be.
Everyone's kind of focusing on, I'm having trouble getting by, and,
yeah,
you know, fair enough. But still, I mean, we're heading for disaster. We've got to, like, the cost, the price of paying, you know, devoting a bit more land to renewable energy is nothing.
Yeah, yeah. I get that there's all sorts of ancillary issues, like how do you recycle solar panels? How do you recycle wind turbines?
Yeah.
You know, how do you remediate a coal mine? Like all things come with issues that you got to solve. But the core issue that the planet is getting hotter, and that is affecting everything we do.
Yeah.
Look at your insurance bill. I just don't. Yeah.
You know, there's houses in the Nullarbor Plain that are underwater at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible what's going on. You know, the sea surface temperature is incredibly high right now. So I don't know. I mean, I just think we're gonna have to get on with this.
Yeah.
This is serious.
It just feels serious. Yeah. 12 months ago, the debate was settled. We had a legislated target. It felt like we were moving faster. And all of a sudden, I feel like we're back to, you know, well, we should keep the thermal coal power plants running longer because it's hard to recycle solar panels. And you know, it's the transmission lines are ugly. I get it. It's not nice to be in your backyard, but like the impact of climate change on rural communities, I don't think it's going to be that. Transmission lines that you're going to be worried about.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, it's complex.
thanks for your excellent questions, everybody. They were great this week. Really enjoyed them. And thanks for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe. I'll be back next week with Stephen Mayne. Send in your question to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. So until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, etc.
And I'm James Thompson, senior Chanticleer columnist at the AFR.